Welcome all sports fans. On this podcast,
no sport is left behind.
I'm Justin Williams.
I'm Cabrera Duran, and this is our brother from Down Under,
me, Wallace Bruce.
We are the Pro Sports Podcasters,
filling you in on the latest news from the world of sports.
Welcome, sports fans. Before we get started on episode 6 of the Pro Sports Podcasters, I'd just like to say for those of you out there in my position that do a lot of production, whether it be audio or video, do yourself a favor and never use some cheap little thumb drive you may have received as a perk when you used to work electronics retail back in the day to transfer 2.5 hours worth of recorded studio time from your mini computer in your recording nook to your desktop in your living room. That 20 feet I had to travel that I used a cheap little thumb drive for basically killed the majority of what was going to be episode 6. As a result of that, don't be surprised if things jump around a little bit this episode. I've had to use some of the previously recorded material that we were intending on saving for later. That's no longer the case. And a few things that we recorded for this episode specifically that I was able to salvage from the mini computer itself. It's another thing. Always make a backup. Always make a backup. But anyways, with that being said, I'm pretty sure you're still going to enjoy the show, and let's get right into it. And now we're going to get into a little something that's happening in your neck of the woods, Nee.
That's right, Co.
The Australian Open.
Indeed. So the draw came out over the weekend. Men's and women's draws are ready to rumble. Hopefully the players are ready to rumble as well. Some of them are in quarantine at the moment, but I think we'll be good to go when Monday comes around in Australia. So we've got some interesting quarters projected. Novak Djokovic is a top seed.
Of course.
And Rafa Nadal is at the second seed, so he's at the other half. But we've got some other names to look out for. We've got guys like Dominic Thiem. He's the third seed. He's the Austrian. He's been moving off the ranks in recent years. Daniil Medvedev. He's the fourth seed.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a name that we haven't really heard much of, but this Russian, he's had 12 straight wins, and he's finished pretty strong. He won the Paris Masters and the ATP Finals, so that's a name to look out for on the men's side of the draw. I know we don't have Roger Federer, we don't have Andy Murray, but there's a new wave in tennis, and it's good for the men's game, because remember, Cope, for the last, 10 years, it's been...
Over 10 years.
Yeah, it's been Nadal, Roger, Novak, Murray, and that's it.
Yeah, that is it. And you're being nice to Murray by including him in that group when it comes right down to it. But yeah, it's time for the men's game to have an influx of new young talent to try and challenge some of these guys at the top. And hopefully we see that begin here at the Australian Open. I do wonder, though, how much COVID is going to affect this, because already they've got 500 people under quarantine because of that one incident at the one hotel. And then on top of that, you have the double hotel split, the split between Adelaide and Melbourne, right. Whereas you have the, you know, top players in 5-star lodgings and the also-rans in 1-star lodgings. So that's going to be an interesting little thing to follow as well as the matches begin.
That's essentially the haves and have-nots. And the tournament director, Craig Tilley, had to come out and admit that, yeah, he wants the big names to go deeper in the tournament, so he's going to look after them. Pretty much what he said. So, yeah, it's interesting. It reminds me a little bit of the World Cup, because I've always had this theory about big nation syndrome. I know you like Holland.
Of course.
I represent Ghana and Australia, two smaller nations. I always feel like the bigger nations get the rub of the green when it comes to the World Cup. So it might be the same thing in tennis. We should look out for a couple of local hopes for Australia. And Australia hasn't won the Australian Open in my lifetime. On the men's side, but we got Nick Kyrgios. He's had a bit of a resurgence, both on and off the court. I think the Australian public is taking a liking to him now with some of his comments on the whole quarantine, and I guess the concerns around COVID. He's definitely had a lot more of a bigger picture view as opposed to some of the players. I also like Francis Tiafoe, the American.
I don't.
Why not?
No, I don't think he's there yet. Okay. I think it's a bit early for him yet, but I don't know. I do like the fact that you brought up Medvedev, because he's playing fantastic right now. Mm. And if you look at the draw, there's a definite path for him to find his way to the final. Mm. He doesn't have the hardest group of the draw, in my opinion, looking at who he has to face each step of the way, right, provided you have the typical winners, losers that are expected, right? Anything can happen. It's an open.
Of course.
Anything can happen. But this should be interesting to watch, and it's about time we get to see some real Grand Slam tennis.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a little while. We lost Wimbledon last year altogether. The French Open was pushed back, and the U.S. Open lost a lot of players because of COVID. But here we go, the first Open of the year. And let's go to the more competitive side, because I honestly find the women's side of the draw much more entertaining because of what I said before.
Always. There's far more competitive women at the top of the table.
Yeah, and you just never know what's going to happen. I mean, Serena is the gold standard of tennis. She's probably the greatest player
ever
on both sides.
That's right. That's right.
That's not even for argument. But even she can have a bad day. The right opponent can knock her off. So the draw is interesting on the women's side. We've got Ashley Barty, the Australian. She's up there. She's number one. She's hoping to bring it home for the local fans. But even then, we got Serena Williams. We've also got Daria Gavrilova, another Australian. I don't know if you've heard of her. But
no, I have not, actually.
She's a name to watch. Okay. I mean, growing up in Australia, that's the thing in summer. You watch tennis by day and you watch cricket at night. So you learn about the Australian tennis players a lot more than you might in other countries.
Is the Canadian there?
That would be Bianca Andreescu. Andreescu is back.
Right on.
Yes. So Canada represent. We have Andreescu. She could be running into Petra Kvitova in the quarterfinals.
Okay, all right.
So that could be an interesting
matchup.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. We've got Garbin Muguruza as well. She's going to be there. So she's in that same quarter with Andreescu. That's almost the quarter of death. As well as Naomi Osaka, who is now part owner of the North Carolina Courage in the NWSL.
That's right.
NWSL just started off this week with their preseason training. So they're off and they're up and running. It'll be interesting to see who's going to jump out of the blocks there, because they've had a bit of a break with COVID and whatnot.
Is Venus playing?
Venus is there. Venus is back at the Open.
That should be interesting to watch. See how she comes back now.
Yeah, she's been around. She has been around. I almost want, is it 20 years? I feel like she's been playing for 20 years.
I can't even begin to think what the total length of time is. Mm. But she had some up and down times, and now she's finding herself sort of back into it. And I think this year is particularly interesting, including Serena in this as well, and that. I don't think they've had the kind of opportunities and time to do nearly as much off the field endeavors as they normally would. I mean, I'm always amazed at how well Serena is able to play again and again and again when in between that, she's got so many other commitments going on
right
off the tennis court. And this will be one of the first events that I see her play in where I'm certain those commitments have been pushed aside. She probably had more time to focus on tennis lately than she has in years. And that would go the same for Venus and anyone else who has significant commitments off the court.
Yeah.
So it should be interesting to see how well she plays now that tennis is sort of the number one thing in her life currently.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point you raised, because I know in the lead up to the Super Bowl, they were talking about the Kansas City Chiefs and the Super Bowl hangover. And people were saying, oh, well, because of COVID, there wasn't really much of a hangover because the players were at home and they just had to train.
That's right. There's a lot less commitments. Mm. You didn't see half the team in new commercials and that sort of thing. They're like not, you always do, right?
Yeah. So that's going to be interesting to see which players have used the time to prepare. And yeah, it's looking like an interesting tournament. I'll be looking out for Sloane Stephens. She won a few years ago at the U.S. Open. She also made the semifinals of the Australian Open, I think, when she was a teenager in 2013. So always interested to see how she goes.
Of course. I think this could be a case of Serena Williams just overpowering the rest of the field, though. I have a feeling with her ability to commit to tennis over the last few months that this could be a case of her reasserting her dominance. She would be my bet to win at the Australian Open.
And if I'm not mistaken, she's one Grand Slam away from breaking the record, right? This has been the hump that she's wanting to get over. She's lost in a few semifinals and finals.
Yeah.
But if she wins this one, she will break the record, which is, I'm pretty sure, held by, I want to say, Margaret Court, who one of the Australian Open courts is named after. But yeah, it all kicks off straight after the Super Bowl, pretty much. 2 weeks of tennis. The sport doesn't end here, so that'll be good.
Yes. We'll definitely be following it as we go along.
Yeah, so just for those listening, the Grand Slam singles titles. Margaret Court is number one as we record in early February with 24, and Serena Williams is at 23.
Oh, okay.
So she just needs one more to equal.
Two more to beat her.
So yeah, could happen in Paris, could happen in Wimbledon. We'll see.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at pro.sports.podcasters for the most current sports news. Now back to the show.
And we're also on Twitter. You can find us at Twitter. Our handle is ppodcasters.
And on Facebook, feel free to join our group, the Pro Sports Podcasters group. Become a fan there and get some inside information as to what's coming up on future episodes, as well as check out our page. We got a page there as well, Pro Sports Podcasters.
Also, in case you may have missed it, we are now on Apple Podcasts. So if you can access us through the good folk at Apple, make sure you leave us a review. And a 5-star review, because that really helps us out with what we're trying to do here. We appreciate your support, and we thank you for listening to the Pro Sports Podcasters.
So yeah, so basically my buddy and I were talking about the disparity between how much men get paid in their sports and how much women get paid in their sports. Mm-hmm. And in some of the sports, it makes sense, right? There's just superstars in some of the men's game, whereas in the women's games, there's a degree of skill that this doesn't, it's not there yet, right? Mm-hmm. But the one place I would argue that women deserve to get paid just as much as men, maybe in some cases even more so depending on their skill level, is tennis and golf.
Yes, I fully agree with that.
Right? Because I mean, I'm a huge fan of golf. I'm a fan of tennis. Wouldn't say huge, but I'm a fan of tennis. I watch both the men's and women's games, and I get the same amount of excitement, really, or value out of watching the men or women in either of those sports. And like I've said many times on my Cold Life Golf channels, I actually think the women's golf game is more beneficial for the average golfer to watch than the men's, because they play in a way that essentially you're supposed to around a course. They dissect a course the way a player should versus some of the men who can overpower a course and play it in a way that you would never even hope to emulate as an amateur golfer.
I see. So it's like the average fan feels more represented?
Correct, right? It's I got into a conversation with a guy one time on my YouTube channel, just chatting back and forth about it. And I basically, the way I compared it was, you know, if you go to see David Copperfield, mm-hmm. he does things that are just amazing.
Right.
But you know it's magic. You know you're being fooled, right? You know it's trickery.
Wait, you're saying magic isn't real?
Like, exactly.
Right. Whoa. Where else does this go? What about Santa Claus? Is he still real?
Occasionally. Oh, depends my God. What country you're in. Right? Oh. But no, it's you go there knowing I'm going to get fooled here.
Right.
Someone like a Dustin Johnson in golf, he's like the equivalent of David Copperfield. What he does, you can basically say is magical. It's almost trickery, because it's something you could never hope to emulate. Mm-hmm. You could never achieve it through normal means. This is a guy who trains, you know, 350 days out of a year, mm-hmm. to achieve what he achieves on the course in perfect physical condition.
Right.
Unless you've got that kind of time to dedicate, there's no way you can do it, right? Absolutely no way. But the men's game allows for that kind of dedication because of the money involved behind it.
Exactly. Do you feel like some of these players who aren't in like female players have secondary jobs?
Well, I mean, in some cases, I think they kind of have to. Something that you'll see both in women's tennis and women's golf. Let's say you subscribe on Instagram to any of the PGA Tour players. Mm-hmm. On their Instagram, you're going to see, of course, the associated marketing that goes along with it. So whatever companies have sponsored them, they're going to represent them in their Instagram. But at the same time, you're basically going to see a lot of things to do with them playing golf.
Yes.
With a high percentage of the women's players, mm-hmm. their Instagram becomes a golf/modeling medium.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're basically forced to represent themselves as models in order to gain additional sponsorship and revenue outside of the game of golf, whereas the men, they don't really require that.
Not at all, no.
So I'm certain, I guarantee you that there are some women on the PGA Tour and some women on the, I guess it would be the WTA, Tennis Tour.
Okay.
Right? That they make more money as models than they do actually playing their sport.
I don't want to use the word disturbing, but that's almost what it is to me.
Right? I'm trying to think of the name. Who is, what's the name of that Russian tennis player that was super popular? Kournikova.
Yes. Okay.
So Anna Kournikova never won any major tennis tournament.
Right.
But she was one of the highest earners on the WTA at that time because of her modeling contracts and her endorsement deals.
Okay.
It was ridiculous to some people that at that time, the top tennis players, the top female tennis players in the world, couldn't make as much as Anna Kournikova just because of the deals she had swung as a model outside of tennis. And it's still like that to a certain degree.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm looking at her right now, actually. Now I remember. Yeah, I don't really remember her from tennis, actually.
No, you probably remember her because she dated nothing but Russian hockey stars. Right? That was it. Like, if you were a Russian hockey star at the time, you dated Anna Kournikova. Like, she dated Fedorov. She dated...
Oh, okay.
Burray.
Oh, yes, Burray.
Pavel Burray. Mm-hmm. So, like, she got a lot of publicity that way. But I think part of that, too, was marketing herself for the endorsement deals and the contracts outside of tennis. So what she did was she parlayed a professional sports career, albeit she wasn't top tier. She was, say, second tier, you know, as far as the top players went. She took that in her looks and turned it into a lucrative career. And that's what I think a lot of these players are still forced to do, even though they're playing at a level that, to me, is equal to the men's game.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I see. I'm digging a little more into her history at the moment, and apparently, I can't tell if she is with or was with, I don't know if she was with for sure, Enrique Iglesias, the singer?
Potentially. That sounds marketable.
Oh, they've been together since 2001. They have three kids.
There you go. Okay. There you go.
Oh, my Lord. It's so strange how it doesn't matter what a female does as an athlete, as long as they can be represented as a model that somehow makes their worth more. That's a really twisted part of society.
She had limited success, but only in doubles. Okay. Mm. So she never won a singles title. Not a one. It wasn't until she teamed up with Martina Hingis, who was at that time, I think, the number one player in the world, that she won some doubles titles, basically off of Martina Hingis's racket. Right. But her real money came through endorsement. And I still think that holds true in a lot of situations.
Wasn't Tiger Woods making more money off endorsement than he was at as a golf at one point?
Potentially. I'd have to really look into it because, again, Tiger is a brand, right? He's his own brand.
Yeah.
That's hard to say because he was winning so much on tour that you'd have to really crunch the numbers to figure it out. But the combination of the two, I mean, ridiculous. Tiger was making ridiculous money. But again, he wasn't making money as a model.
No.
That's the difference.
You are correct. He was making money as a player for the most part. I mean, he did have a lot of sponsorship with like Nike and Gillette and all that fun stuff. Hey, Justin here. Thank you for listening to our podcast thus far. If you'd like to read about more exclusive content, you can follow us on Twitter at @PPodcasters. Also on Twitter, you can connect with us via the messaging app. And we will have a conversation if we see fit.
So this past week, we've been following the negotiations between the MLS Player Association and the league, hoping that there wouldn't be a lockout because it was getting close to the potential of that happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they've arranged at some sort of a deal. Can you go over that, Nee?
Yeah, well, we're recording on Sunday morning and I couldn't sleep very well overnight. I was staying up to see if there was going to be an agreement or not, because Friday 11:59 Eastern was the deadline.
Yes.
for some sort of agreement to be put in place. Otherwise, we're going to have a lockout. Now, truth be told, I did fall asleep. and I did wake up about 3 in the morning. But the first thing I did, didn't go to the bathroom, didn't get a glass of water. I went straight to the interwebs, and I wanted to see, are we going to have men's soccer in North America or not? And I can tell you that we have a tentative agreement for the new collective bargaining agreement between the Major League Soccer and the Players Association. So if you, to get you caught up, basically what happened was end of last year, late December, the league did a force majeure maneuver. Because of COVID, and because there were no fans in the stands, the league was impacted in terms of revenue.
Correct.
So they said, we need to review the CBA and basically adjust it. So what they wanted to do as part of that was extend the CBA, the current CBA that's in place, for another 2 years to 2027.
Okay.
The significance of that is that locks in the current terms up to and just past the next World Cup in North America, which is 2026.
That's right.
So the players will lose some leverage in terms of being able to renegotiate favorable terms with their members, their players.
Depending on their performance in such a marquee event.
Right. And the union did say, hey, we basically conceded $150 million in wages last season to help get the season restarted and finished, because they had the bubble in Florida and then they finished the season in 2020. So that's where the haggling was happening. There was a deadline in end of January. That was extended by a week to February 4th. That was extended again by 24 hours. And then what happened on Friday night, before we record now, is the executive board of the union voted for an agreement. It was 24-11. So now all the players will get to vote on it.
Okay.
If there's a simple majority there, then it will go back to the board's league of governance, or basically the owners, if you will. And if they approve that, then we can have training camp towards the end of February, and then we can get the season started in March and go as we were. Now, in terms of the nuts and bolts, here's the deal. Some of the benefits, there will be no cuts to salaries in 2021. So that's a win for the players.
Yes.
And there'll be improved free agency terms for 2026 and 2027, so just after the World Cup in North America. So players who are 24 years of age and have had 4 years of playing time or service qualify for this free agency. Under the previous deal, you needed to have been playing for 5 years. Yeah. So I guess that's another win for the players. There'll be an overall increase of salary by 10% in 2027, and there'll be some revenue sharing from the new media rights contract deal. The players are going to get a percentage of that.
Okay.
So it's in the figure of roughly $100 million, which is good. 2023 and 2024, that percentage of the TV rights deal is going to be 12.5%. The thing here is that's a decrease. That's a halving of what they used to get.
Yes.
25%. But from 2025 to 2027, that figure goes back up to 25%.
Okay, so that's done basically to recoup the losses from this previous year.
That's right. So I guess the MLS is looking ahead to this season. The coronavirus is not improving in North America, so it's highly unlikely we're going to get fans across all stadiums.
Definitely not.
There might be some exceptions, but overall, the league's going to be making a loss again.
That's right.
So rather than put the players under the pump by asking for another cut in salary, they've tried to come to this agreement.
And this is an important time in soccer as well. When you have to look at where we're at right now, going forward, as to what's going to happen with soccer. So, I mean, we have the Olympics coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Olympic soccer. That's going to impact a number of these players.
Mm.
You have Euro.
Right, Euro 2021, yeah.
Just because it's MLS doesn't mean there's European players aren't being represented.
That's exactly right.
Right. Then you've got World Cup. There's so much that can be impacted if this season wasn't to happen.
Yeah, we've also got the Copa America in South America.
Oh, yeah. I'd be certain if they had gone to a lockout that a number of the players would have left the league. You would have found them on different teams back in Europe or elsewhere in order to keep their game shape going for all of these important international events that are coming up after.
Right. So that's the on-field impact, because players are trying to get game time.
That's right. I
mean, we're Arsenal fans. You look at Matt Ryan, the Australian goalkeeper. He basically told Brighton, you better loan me or get rid of me if you don't want to start me. And they said, okay, let him go on loan to Arsenal, because he needs game time so he can be in the frame for the World Cup qualifiers.
That's right. To even be considered.
Right.
Right. They've got to see something. Mm-hmm. If you're riding a bench somewhere, doesn't matter how good you are, you're just in a situation that can't highlight your abilities. Yeah. you're going to get passed up for somebody who maybe shouldn't be there at this point. Mm-hmm. So these games, every single game matters to some of these guys because they could be right on the cusp of representing their country.
Exactly. And even on a higher level, a lockout is just, it takes eyes off your game. I mean, let's be clear. The women's game in North America, in my opinion, is ahead of the men's game. The men's game has catching up to do with North America. And if there was an MLS lockout, it'll kill off some teams. It'll kill off some interest in some of those smaller markets.
That's right. I think a team like the TFC would be fine. Okay, I think our market is strong enough and has enough of interest in soccer itself because of how multicultural Toronto is as a whole. But there are other markets where I think a lockout would just end that franchise. They'd be forced to move somewhere, potentially, in order to keep going.
There we go. I mean, you look at last year's champions, Columbus Crew, they were talking about moving to Austin. I think it was only a year or two ago. There was fans had to campaign to keep them in Columbus.
That's right.
I mean, Montreal, they look safe nowadays, but I think about their baseball team. They had a lockout in 1994 and Montreal.
When they were the best team in the league.
Right. When they were on the way to winning the World Series. And then
that's right. What happened since?
The fans stopped showing up. They had to move games to Puerto Rico, and then Washington said, okay, we'll have the team.
That's right.
And baseball has never come back to Montreal, even though Tampa Bay are talking about it and basically moving towards...
moving their franchise there.
Right, because Montreal actually has fans as opposed to...
actually has fans.
It's not like Tampa Bay where, you know, fans come to the game after going to the beach. If they're feeling it, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, even out their tan.
All right. Oh, there's baseball. Yeah, okay, we'll go watch some baseball. Nah, actually.
It's 2-for-1 bruise day. We'll go check it out.
Right. I want to catch some waves. Shout out to Tampa Bay. Yeah. But even then, Tampa Bay used to have an MLS team. I don't know if you remember the Tampa Bay Mutiny.
Yeah.
Back in the day. They haven't come back. They folded just at the turn of the millennium, turn of the century. They didn't have enough fans coming in. But seriously, a lockout would have killed off some fan bases. So this is really important. Hopefully they can put the finishing touches on this, tie a bow on it. We can move on with the season because it's good for the game has progressed. You see the number of American players in Europe nowadays. That comes from development. That comes from having an opportunity at home.
That's right. Well, and being noticed. Mm-hmm. And being noticed. I mean, there are other leagues that you can play in North America, but were they getting any sort of attention? None whatsoever.
Right.
Just as how we wake up on Saturday morning and we see what's going on in Europe and all the highlights of the European matches are going on there. Mm. I have a feeling that if you're in England somewhere, then you're probably getting occasional updates on what's going on in MLS matches because of some of the players that are represented here.
Exactly.
Whereas before, that was not the case. I don't think they even thought soccer was being played in North America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what happens as we go along with the MLS situation.
I'm a fan.
I'm a fan too.
Something I have always surmised that has proven to be true is that watch one UFC event with me or engage in, say, 2 or 3 conversations about MMA, and you will become an MMA fan. Have been interested in it before, or don't even know what MMA stands for, watch one UFC event, or let me talk about MMA for, say, 40 minutes, and boom, you're a dedicated fan. And that's what happened to Justin, one of the members here of the Pro Sports Podcasters, when he got talking to me about the upcoming fight with Conor McGregor. Since then, he has now become a dedicated fan, and that led to this conversation.
I found a MMA YouTube channel that I have been addicted to, and I also blame you. So,
you blame me, do you?
Yes. I've learned things that I wish I knew about this earlier.
Like what?
Like pride fighting, the scandals that happened.
Oh, Pride, man. The Pride might have been the pinnacle of MMA spectacle.
According to my research, it was, and when it first came out in the early 2000s. Go on.
Right? Because, well, one, the Japanese know how to do spectacle, right?
Yep.
They're right up there with the Americans. It's a kind of a battle between the two as to who can make the more spectacular event. But when it came to MMA at that time, Japan had the edge, definitely, over the UFC. The other thing is during that time, that's the height of the steroid era. So that's before USADA. That's when these guys were using any supplement they could, juicing any way possible to get bigger and stronger. Now, not all of them were doing it, but a lot of them were, and especially the guys in Pride, because Pride had zero testing.
Yes.
And the UFC, they made a tiny effort to see if there's some shit going on. It wasn't a massive effort, but a little bit of an effort, whereas in Pride, I think it was practically encouraged, like, go ahead.
Well, from what I was hearing, there was a UFC fighter. He was first in Pride, then went to UFC. He was this Asian gentleman, I forget his name. But he had mentioned that actually in the Pride's contract, they said they were going to test for certain drugs, cocaine, marijuana, heroin, whatever. But it didn't say it was going to test for steroids. And then it even said in writing, we do not test for steroids. Sign here.
Go ahead. Yeah, exactly.